Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron, and I'd like to welcome to the studio Ngaranoa Renata. Good morning.
Ai, atamari e koutou mā. Ka nui te mihi atu ki a koutou I tēnei te wā o Ngāhuru. So we're entering into another time of seasonal changes. And for us, the word, one of the kupu is Ngāhuru, which means it's a relationship of the migration of birds, or those bird manu that are travelling, that leave our country and go to warmer countries like Papua New Guinea.
Yes.
The Pipi Whareroa.
Yeah.
The Koe Koea, which also leaves our shores. But on their journey, and many other manu as well, they drop their feathers. Is that a way?
Shed.
No, that's not very poetic.
The technical, you would say they would shed their feathers.
They shed their feathers, and so that's why you find them when you're walking. You think, oh wow, what's this? Mm. It's called Ngāhuru. It's to do with that indicator or sign that we're changing into autumn.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, they're certainly going to be getting the hurry up this week for that. Today and yesterday especially is going to feel like,
Yeah, it's what it is, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll still have some good weather. It's not all downhill from
good
here.
Good weather. Good and bad weather, that's a very strange sort of concept to me. How we talk about rain as being such, you know, oh, bad weather is on its way. And yet, many of us also welcome the rain.
You're dead right. I've been trained by the weather is all about having a sunny day so you can go to the beach, even though I don't go to the beach or anything like that. But it has been, I have enjoyed the sunny weather we've had this summer,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It has
so
been really nice. Mm. Yeah, beautiful days. So today we want to talk about a project that Ngaranoa was involved with Australia's National Radio, and about the Te Pahi Medal. And we did talk about, in the past we've talked about that you were working on this, but they've made a podcast, and when they make a podcast, it's not like when I make a podcast and I just got an interview and recorded it and uploaded it. They've edited it, they've researched it thoroughly, they've got you involved, they've got people from different countries involved. So this is a production.
Over a period of 6 months, once the call came through to Komako, because...
This is your daughter?
Yes, my daughter, who was a filmmaker and had made a film for Te Papa and the Auckland Museum, based on the repatriation of this medal that belonged to Te Pahi, a paramount chief of the Bay of Islands. And at that time she made this film that they used within their settings, and it was seen by someone in Australia who wanted to go further and look at how Australia, that dual cultural heritage, could make a podcast for ABC Radio Australia.
Mm.
And so we began the negotiations and how that could unfold, being really aware that our history was often not told by ourselves.
Yeah.
And this was absolutely something we wanted to be in charge of, actually,
So that it wasn't yet another time of your history being told by, this time by Australians, for Pete's sake.
Well, Te Pahi received the medal from Philip Gidley King, who was then the governor in New South Wales of the new colony that was forming, that was coming through from England.
Yes.
In Paramatta. Paramatta was the original government of this part of the colony, the Commonwealth.
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't think Australia wasn't all one, by the English, wasn't considered to be one country at that point, I think. We had several governments. You couldn't drive very fast in those days, so it was a bit hard to govern a whole country. That was a gift to Te Pahi, who was visiting the colony.
Yes, Te Pahi visited Sydney Poihakina, is the Māori name for Sydney.
Yeah.
Which is the name of our local marae.
Yeah.
As well.
What does it mean?
That's a good question. I'll get back to you about okay. that. Well, it translates to Sydney. It's Sydney.
Right, but that can't be what it means here.
No. No, but Poihakina is the original, not actually, it's not the original name of Sydney, but it's what we know in Māori.
Yeah.
Poihakina. And so he visited there, which was back in the day, pre-treaty, we're talking about 1805, by ship, 6 weeks. 6 weeks out there on the ocean, navigating, well, on a ship.
He must have been one of the first Māori to hop on a European ship and travel like that.
I'm
guessing, I really don't know, but that's very early.
Yes, at that time he also took four of his sons from the Te Pahi Islands, which are situated in the Bay of Islands.
Right.
And that's where he governed as a rangatira at that time. So he wanted to negotiate trade agreements with the new colony, very, very entrepreneurial, wanting to establish rangatiratanga, an understanding that here back in Aotearoa there were tribal areas, and make that awareness known to the fledgling colony that were coming. The whalers and sealers were already here, and they were already having quite an impact. Not so much in a positive way, although they were being embraced, but some of their practices were highly offensive at that time, but that's another story. The way they were doing their whaling practices and that wasn't sitting very well at all.
So was he trying to establish that there was already a government here in the form of the hapu leadership throughout the islands?
I think he just assumed that they would know that was what it was. He wasn't really fighting for the land at that point.
Mm.
That didn't come until much later when he realised that relationship was actually not going to be about shared governance. It was actually turned to custard, really.
Yeah.
Te tiriti o waitangi, it was a relationship that was never honoured. So, it would have been a very... But yes, this is all pre-treaty.
Pre-treaty. Yeah,
so my family, as in Kōmako, Whetu and myself, agreed to sit with and across Zoom, regular Zooms, to negotiate what part of the interviews that we had collected earlier when the medal was first... held at Sotheby's in Australia, in Sydney, and it became available for sale.
So that's when it first re-emerged, sort
of. Yeah, 200 years. 200 years it had sat in a vault.
Mm.
We were never to know who was the person who was selling it.
Yeah.
That never came through. Sotheby's would not share that. However, it was quite a big story which we navigated... the interviews, we were given exclusive rights because of being Te Pahi's relatives, whenanga, to do those interviews. So no newspapers were allowed to collect any information or interview until a certain point. And so those interviews that we collected have become absolute treasures that are used in this podcast.
So that you're able to keep a handle on the story, the information that emerged, and make sure it was accurate. There's a noisy van leaving. I can hear the high-pitched bit in my headphones, so maybe the listeners can hear it. So that was... Because this for people who don't really understand, that's such a big deal for Māori. I'm learning that their stories were told by other people and mistold or misrepresented. And so I feel like that's what you're trying to do here was to keep control of the information that was coming out so that you could make sure it was accurate.
The information was really, we were guiding the interviews as we met people and were given names. The person that was pivotal to that was my mother's first cousin, Dr. Deirdre Brown. She's a professor in the School of Architecture, and her specialty, one of her specialties, is the Te Pahi was gifted the first known European house when he returned to Aotearoa after staying in Sydney and the surrounding area for 3 months. He was gifted a house, and that was sent back on the Lady Nelson with him and many other gifts. So that was some through Deirdre. We learned that this medal had become available for sale, and we were very interested. So very quickly, there was an interest in how to repatriate it and to see if it was actually we could actually receive it back because it was stolen. We knew that it had been stolen.
So
but that didn't happen. We didn't get it back. It was sold. It was actually sold. The first joint purchase of Te Papa and the Auckland Museum. They jointly brought it.
That would tend to suggest it was expensive when they do that.
It's tiny. It's 300, it was 320,000.
Yeah, but you weren't paying for the weight of it, were you?
Not at all.
No.
It had not a story to tell. It had a story to tell.
Mm.
And it was, you know, engraved, and it has its own story, and there it was. And it was also a reclamation of storylines which we knew. We knew the stories, but we had no, if you like, concrete proof because there was no medal. And
yeah,
then the medal appeared.
Right.
200 years later, and we go, that's the medal that we've been talking about that was gifted.
That's incredible that the memory of the medal survived so long.
Oh, that's because there was the story is not, how do you say, it's full of trauma. Te Pahi was blamed for another significant historical happening which happened in the harbour of Whangaroa, and that became known as the Boyd Massacre.
And that's up near Bay of Islands.
Yes, yeah, that's north of the Bay of Islands. That's where, you know, both my parents are from. And because his name, Te Pahi, but it was actually Te Puhi. So what happened was his islands were, they were invaded and his people were killed. Not his people, our people were killed. The river, the sea was red. And so it was never, there was, Te Pahi was not responsible for that, for the invasion or the incident, the utu that took place on the Boyd, but some sailors, some whalers had decided that he was responsible, and seven ships came in, and they massacred men, women, children.
Yeah.
So that's why it's got a long memory, because it's never been told.
It's associated with an atrocity, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, and it was, still very much grieving that history. So when the medal, we saw the medal, and there was this short film, and now this podcast, it's all about reclaiming and understanding that we too have, we have stories that have yet to be told properly.
Now I understand why this was so important to you, because you were messaging me about it several times.
Just many people lost their lives.
And I didn't really do it justice last week when I said that I just said you'd been part of this thing.
So we got intimately involved in even the languaging. The podcast was to be 26.5 minutes long, so that took a huge amount of effort on our part to decide which parts were not relevant. So Samuel Marsden featured in the original interviews. That's a whole other story. He was actually not highly regarded in Puihakina by the colony. And
right.
He was sent out to New Zealand at that time. And in Australia, they just simply shuddered at the thought that he was going to come as a in a priesthood, in the form of the priesthood, and start to colonize through preaching Christianity. They didn't like him at all. The colony didn't like him. And they sent him here.
Was he banished to New Zealand? Seemed like
he was definitely
the wildest of the wilds back then, I presume, to people in Sydney.
And yet he has received some accolades which are very unfortunate for us, because they should never have been given such a high regard.
I know his name.
Yeah, Samuel Marsden.
Yeah.
Yeah, he features on postage stamps, and not only postage stamps, but people know him. They know him.
Yeah,
they
I don't even really know why. I just throughout my life, his name has continually popped up.
Yeah,
You know him as a significant name for this country, and
establishing the colony through his priesthood as a minister.
Yeah, and that's a whole other story too.
It's a whole other story.
It's a whole other podcast. So what we want to do, if you've said everything you want to play this podcast that's been done by ABC in Australia, and they're happy for everyone to do that and to share it, so we're going to do that. Do you speak in it?
Yes, I do.
You do speak in it, okay.
Yes. You'll hear. We went through a lot of into the studio, and Fetu is a narrator. I am at the beginning as well. And, yes, a lot of negotiation about, yeah, it's a very kumako place, Taonga Puoro. Jeremy Male is this absolute magician who is, he was the led the recording in the studio here at Wintec, but he also plays the piano in there.
And in Australia, were they used to people wanting to have so much say and how this information came out? Like, to be honest, for Pākehā New Zealanders, we think we've done a better job than equivalent white people in Australia, and we tend to think that they'll be rough Australians and trample over everything that you hold dear. So, but how was the ABC to work with in that regard?
We were very respectful, because we knew that they were looking for that to forge a relationship, and share the medal, because the medal came from their people, from Philip Gidley King.
Of course,
It was gifted to Te Pahi, and really it was the person who was really negotiating with us on many levels, and was Ruth Barron, and she was amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. But yes, we were punctuating the space with, no, you mustn't talk about the mana whenua of Australia, because we don't know them. We haven't met them. So we will not include them, because we have not asked their permission. And they found that quite interesting and powerful, that we would say, nope.
You have to get them to tell that they're part of the story.
They must tell their own story. That's their story, not ours.
All right, let's get underway then. So we've queued it up, and we've got time in the show, plenty of time. So we'll come back, and we're going to listen to ourselves. Well, I'll be hearing it for the first time, and we'll come back at the end and sign off.
Hi, Kirsty Melville here, and welcome to the History Listen. Over 200 years ago, Te Pahi, one of the first documented Maori chiefs to arrive in Sydney, was gifted a silver medal, a taonga, by Governor Gidley King.
The time of Te Pahi, he embraced the two worlds coming together. Although they were in conflict, but out of conflict comes the resolution for peace, to finding a pathway forward.
But then, the medal disappeared.
This is an important taonga to us, but also to our nation. It is meaning for our people, and will bring them back together again. It belongs to an important rangatira, and it was part of an important gift. It recognises the sovereignty of the Crown, but also the sovereignty of Māori people.
Two centuries later, this treasured medal resurfaced in a Sydney auction house. Although this story is deeply sad for narrators Naranoa Renata and daughter Fetu Silva, telling it has been an opportunity to reimagine and reclaim their history. New Zealand's Māori language helps tell the story, starting with the medal, the taonga, which roughly translates into English as treasure. Naranoa Renata takes up the story.
Nau mai haere mai. Welcome to this Pūrākau, a story about a silver medal, a taonga moulded, that was gifted to Te Pahi, a paramount chief of the northern tribes of Aotearoa. This is a story about great exchange between two worlds, two cultures of hope.
This is a story from the heart, with deep personal meaning for me and my whānau, my family, with our whakapapa, our genealogy going all the way back to this tangata, this leader, he rangatira.
He moka pona ahau, no Ngāti Kahu ki Whangaroa, no reira, ko Ngaro no Renata, ahau.
We are descendants of Te Pahi. Ko whetu e ti Doreen Silver, tōku ingoa.
Ko tēnei mea ko te taonga, ka tuku iho, ka tuku iho, ka tuku iho. Te reo he taonga, ngā whakakai kei runga te, kei rute te taringa, kei te kaki e mauana, he taonga ena, he taonga te kōrero, te whakapapa, ngā kōrero pepeha a o tātou Mātua Tīpuna, ngā kōrero Pūrākau, kei ko nā katoa.
Māori elder, Sir Hari Williams.
So, taonga embraces a wide area of meaning. Now, it could be a waiata, a few notes in a waiata. It could be a piece in a whakapapa where it identifies your name. It could be a greenstone, a piece that people wear that has a story, has a name that identifies with the land, with the ancestors, with the source of that particular tribe. Now, in Te Pahi's case, he had a relationship with the governor in Sydney, King, Philip King. And so to cement that relationship, a taonga was moulded.
In 2014, that taonga, a silver medal given to our ancestor Te Pahi 2 centuries before, appeared for auction at Sotheby's in Sydney.
We had lost trace of it. And then all of a sudden, last week, we were advised that it was going up for auction. We're talking about 2 centuries of shared history between our two countries. So now we see it, now we don't. And it's so disappointing.
And just as Kiribaba o Ngāuri o Rahiri pays his respects to our ancestral taonga, he was quickly escorted out when he stood up to speak.
It's actually a sad, sad moment for us, because after 204 years, we see it for a week and it's gone.
Gary Singer was the director of Sotheby's at the time.
If they had a claim, they should have put up their hand and said ages ago, gee, this medal belonged to me, where is it?
Professor Deirdre Brown, historian at the University of Auckland and a direct descendant of Te Pahi, was sent an article that Te Pahi's medal was to go up for auction at Sotheby's.
So, on the day of the auction, it was all over the Sydney Morning Herald, plus a number of major Australian newspapers, these people doing these very brave hakas outside Sotheby's. Also, that was the day that we were potentially going to court, and I'd signalled at that point that I couldn't afford to be the plaintiff, and they were seeking other plaintiffs in my place.
For Deirdre, the cost of seeking an injunction to stop the sale of Te Pahi's medal would have been over $800,000.
I had to think, you know, would it be worth potentially losing my house over this? And I was mindful of the fact that a lot of my research had been about the loss of Te Pahi's house, and I'd wondered whether or not he would want me to lose my house in trying to get the medal back.
Mm-hmm.
The medal was made by two convicts called Austin and Murand. They were bank forgers. One was Irish and the other one was French. And they were employed making trinkets for Mrs. King, Philip Gidley King's wife, the Governor of New South Wales's wife. The medal is made out of two silver watch cases hammered together. And that was because bullion was in short supply in New South Wales at the time. It has a beautiful inscription on it, but I guess more importantly from us, you'll see that the letters King George are the same size and in the same font as Te Pahi, which is large and capitalised, which indicates that perhaps the people that made it and the people that instructed them to make it wanted to put Te Pahi on the same par as the King of England.
This was the first known taonga of its kind to be gifted to a rangatira of Aotearoa, pre He Whakaputanga, the Declaration of Independence, and Te Tiriti or Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi. Three significant markers in our shared history.
I think what's really interesting about the award of this medal by Governor King in Sydney in 1806 is that it was spontaneous recognition by a trading partner of a substantial volume of trade and migration across the Tasman at a period long before the treaty in 1840.
Roy Clear, director of the Auckland War Memorial Museum.
And it is interesting to look at what Queen Victoria instructed her first governor at the time of 1840 and the signing of the treaty. She warned that proper respect should be paid to Maori trade and to the investment that had been made by Maori people in understanding what the potential of trade was. So I think this is just a very vivid example of a recognition from a third party of Te Pahi's significance as an entrepreneur.
The job of the rangatira was protect the whānau in the village. And the rangatira had the authority, absolute authority over the whole tribe. Only the rangatira can gift a piece of land.
Māori elder Sir Hare Williams explains Te Pahi's rangatiratanga.
People like Te Pahi were gifting land to missionaries, to build schools, to build churches, to build hospitals, to build roads in New Zealand, and to open up a new country.
During the early 19th century, Te Pahi travelled twice to the British colony of New South Wales.
There was great celebration on his arrival.
Jorge Paruhe, a descendant of Te Pahi, based in Sydney, describes Te Pahi's reception on the first visit.
He was one of the first documented, noted arrivals of Māori chiefs there that had pageantry. He was seen as an important person in the new colonies. He also was starting to acquire and generate relationships where he could see trade opportunities, where he could take hold of certain things and transfer those to his people of New Zealand, but also to increase his own mana in the area, mana being his prestige, being his standing, to increase that not just with his people, but with all the tribal people around him.
Te Pahi went to Sydney in 1805 with four of his sons because he'd heard of the generosity of Philip Gidley King, who had hosted other Māori in the previous century. And he went to Philip Gidley King. Philip Gidley King instantly knew who he was as someone who had assisted a number of whalers and sealers in supplying them with potatoes and wood and water, and offered him generosity. And between them, they built this really important relationship, this mutual understanding. King saw significant trade opportunities with Māori in the Bay of Islands and then gave him this medal as, I guess, to show him how he esteemed his friendship and wanted this to continue. But more importantly, the medal recognised from one sovereign nation, the British Crown, the sovereignty of Māori within the Bay of Islands.
Te Pahi grew up in that world where aliens came across the seas. They arrived on our shores, never before seen. And in that moment, everything changed and it would never, ever be the same.
This is curator Matu Baker, inside Te Papa Tongarewa, the Museum of New Zealand, describing Te Pahi's worldview and leadership role.
He was groomed to leadership from birth. He carried the burden of responsibility for a great many people. Not that I think he ever thought it would be a burden. And just the way that he engaged with the opportunity that was presented in that moment and went out on that intrepid journey, knowing, well, not knowing, what would be the outcome of that. He took his children with him. His family went with him. He put everything on the line. And it's just a remarkable odyssey, an absolute visionary hero in our history.
So Te Pahi spent around 3 months in New South Wales, and pretty much as soon as he arrived, he was greeted by Governor King.
Historian Dr. Rowan Howitt explains how Te Pahi and Governor King developed a mutual understanding.
Te Pahi came with a proposal for King to send a surgeon to, and possibly some other British colonists, to live at the Bay of Islands with Te Pahi. And he would send some of his people back to New South Wales to work as shepherds. So Te Pahi, at the end of his three-month stay in New South Wales, Governor King chartered a ship called the Lady Nelson to specifically take Te Pahi and his family back to New Zealand and ensure that they arrived safely. And as they were preparing for that departure from Sydney, Te Pahi was gifted an enormous range of goods. The most famous one is a silver medal that was made on King's orders and inscribed for Te Pahi. But he was also given huge amounts of tools, of seeds, a British military uniform, and perhaps most interestingly, a prefabricated house. It was packed into the Lady Nelson and sent back with him. And I think the one disappointment that Te Pahi had in his stay in New South Wales was that he and King had discussed this idea of King sending a surgeon and possibly some other colonists to live under Te Pahi's protection, who could help to orchestrate trade, while Te Pahi would then send back some of his people to work as shepherds and learn pastoral skills. This didn't happen. King pulled out of the project when, just before Te Pahi left, he received news that his resignation had been accepted, so he didn't want to commit his successor to that project. So I think that was Te Pahi's one disappointment, and King records Te Pahi as being much chagrined by this disappointment. But then Te Pahi takes matters into his own hands in a way.
Through Te Pahi's hard work, through Te Pahi's hard trade, he created surpluses for the Ngāpuhi people in the far north.
Hohe Paruhe, a descendant of Te Pahi.
He created livestock excess. He created crop excess. Obviously, a very well-laid trade acquisition plan. The influence that he had on the beginning of that economy had its high point between 1830 through to the 1840s, where Māori generated 25 times the exports that they were importing.
Sadly, things didn't stay like this for long. What happened next in this story is a tragic event, one that continues to hold deep grief for the descendants of Te Pahi. Here's historian Rowan Howitt.
The next major event in terms of Te Pahi's relationship with New South Wales was the Boyd Massacre in December 1809. We don't have a really clear account of what actually happened during this event, but what we do know is that the Boyd was en route to South Africa and stopped at Whangaroa Harbour in New Zealand to collect a cargo of timber. It's unclear exactly why the massacre occurred, but the kind of historical consensus is that Tiara, who was a Māori chief from Whangaroa, had joined several British ships as a sailor and had experienced mistreatment, most recently on the Boyd, where he was allegedly flogged by the captain. And this was a very serious insult, both to him and to his people. And so, for that reason, it is said that Tiara orchestrated an attack on the Boyd that killed most of the passengers and crew. When British whalers who were in the vicinity became aware of this, they decided to orchestrate their own revenge attack and came to the conclusion that it was Te Pahi that was responsible for the attack. That may have been because of a miscommunication. Tiara's brother, Te Pui, may have been the one responsible, and it purely comes down to a confusion over a name. It's also possible that Te Pahi was involved in some way, and he does seem to have travelled to Whangaroa soon after the massacre and to have taken some goods from the Boyd. And so the European whalers blamed Te Pahi and orchestrated a series of three revenge attacks against Te Pahi's pa. Initially they fired cannons at it, and then there were two direct attacks where they killed a large number of people. We don't know what happened to Te Pahi himself. He died very soon after, but it's unclear if he died during those attacks or in the aftermath. The Boyd massacre certainly brought to an end that short period of optimism, at least for the next 10 years or so. Attitudes towards the Boyd massacre in New South Wales were openly horrified, and it led to a lot of deeply negative language used about Māori, including the idea that you can never trust a New Zealander, was a quote that emerged out of the responses to the Boyd massacre. And I do think that the way that relationship turned out would have been a disappointment to King. So in the aftermath of the attacks on Te Pahi's pa in the wake of the Boyd massacre, Te Pahi's medal that had been given to him by King disappeared, and its whereabouts were pretty much unknown until it was rediscovered and came up for auction in 2014.
Who would have known that Te Pahi's medal, a taonga, a symbol, a tiny object with a very big story, one which confirms Māori sovereignty by the British, who would have known that it would hold such significance? While no one knows exactly how, 2 centuries later, Te Pahi's medal ended up in that Sydney auction. Sotheby's director Gary Singer has a bit of background information.
Oh, it's an Australian vendor, and it has been in the Australian family for many, many years, for many generations. It had been kept safely in a bank vault and had been part of the family history, and the generation who were now the custodians of it thought it was the right time to release it, and they asked us to offer it for sale.
Deirdre recalls how family and friends mobilised to try and return the medal.
One of the things that happened was that Australian Māori, Māori in Sydney, specifically Ngā Uri o Rāhiri, which are Sydney-based Ngāpuhi, heard about the medal, were contacted by Hugh. He has a cousin who's part of that group, and the discussion started amongst email about this medal being important and potentially being stolen. They rallied amongst themselves. Some of them took direct protest action against Sotheby's, which led to a haka outside Sotheby's the night before the auction. Another member of the group, Marcia Ho, who works in a legal firm, talked to her bosses about this medal and its potential to be repatriated through injunction. And actually, as the case built up and it was developed, I felt that finally Te Pahi might have his day in court, so at least we'd have that, even if we couldn't get the medal back by that means. As it turned out, it was decided not to go to court because no plaintiff could find the money. So it all hinged on that singular moment at the auction. Who would buy it? Would it be the museums or would it be somebody else? And fortunately for us, it was the museums that purchased the medal with our full support. The medal was finally able to come home.
Lene Pōhatu, Tumuaki Director of Māori Projects and Development at Auckland War Memorial Museum, expresses how this was groundbreaking.
So, as far as we know, this is one of the first times that the two largest museums in New Zealand have ever partnered together to purchase one taonga. So the time period in which we had to make that decision was very quick. So we were hearing what Uri of Te Pahi and his iwi were saying, that this was a really significant taonga to them. So in that time we had to get some endorsement from the descendants and then make a decision, get some approval internally to spend money on it. And that was done in about a 24-48 hour period.
The return of the Te Pahi medal is important on a national level. It comes to us at a time when Māori are questioning whether or not they had ceded their sovereignty to the Crown. And here is an object, a tiny object with a very big story to tell about the recognition of Māori sovereignty by the British Crown pre-treaty. So it has a constitutional importance. I think its historical importance is that it speaks of a pact that was made between two very important leaders, one based in Sydney and the other one based in Aotearoa, New Zealand, based on mutual respect. And these are the sorts of relationships that we're still striving towards today. It's a relationship of understanding, of mutual respect, respect for each other's sovereignty, of seeing opportunity in each other's culture.
You know, the people who had the taonga and maybe other taonga that belongs to us, they cared for it. You know, they don't know who we are, but they cared for it. And I started to think, especially with this one, because it's not a Māori taonga, it belongs here and it was made here. So you don't look at it and say, oh, that's a greenstone, that's one of ours.
Sydney-based Marcia Ho, another direct descendant of Te Pahi, describes our thinking about kaitiakitanga, or guardianship.
Would we have given it that much care if it had stayed with us originally? I hope so. Or would we just thought of it as some Pākehā thing that was given to one of our ancestors and just put it to the side? I don't know. But that was an interesting thought for me, and for that we should be grateful that whoever had it had cared for it long enough that it's come back. And that it's come back now, while we're telling Te Pahi's story, it could have come back when? Anytime. It's 200 years and it turns up now.
Te Pahi's medal serves as a navigational tool, a symbol of hope, respect, peace. Sir Hare explains.
The time of Te Pahi, he embraced the two worlds coming together. Although they were in conflict, but out of conflict comes the resolution for peace, to finding a pathway forward. So taonga, when they come back, fulfill the promise of the ancestors. We as Māori people have this thing about taonga travel the world. They're like road maps, they tell us where to go. But this taonga returns, like all taonga. And my advice to our children, to our mums and dads, to grandparents, is that three things really. Allow our children to identify taonga, to touch it, to feel it, and to know the story behind it. I think our children should be taught how to wear their taonga on their arm like a badge of honour, and to live up to that honour, to be honoured by what it is to have a tupuna like Te Pahi. Although he's gone, but his legacy remains, and that legacy is one of friendship, one of bringing people together.
And by returning this medal, this taonga has spoken with its story of hope and peace. May it continue to speak for generations to come. Nō reira, kia tau te rangi mārie.
Kōrihi ake ngā manu, tākiri mai te ata. Ka ao, ka ao, ka auatea. Tihei, mauri ora.
The medal that spoke was co-created by Komako Silva, Naranoa Renata, Fetu Silva and Ruth Barron. Dr. Jeremy Mayle was the sound engineer in Aotearoa and John Jacobs was the sound engineer on Gadigal land in Australia. I'm Kirsty Melville. You've been listening to The History Listen. See you next time.
Kōrihi ake ngā manu, tākiri mai te ata. Ka ao, ka ao, ka auatea. Tihei, mauri ora.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
You are, in fact, listening to Raglan Community Radio. That was a podcast from ABC in Australia about their Te Pahi medal. And if you were tuned in at the start, you would have heard Naranoa Renata talking about her part in that and her daughters Fetu and Komako. And the story tells itself. If you came in halfway through, go to ABC in Australia, abc.net.au, and look for the podcast, The Medal That Spoke. And it is part of a series, The History Listen, it's called that series, The History Listen, hosted by Kirsty Melville. And she was telling me there's a few little things I want to add in. When they, of course, when they heard about this, a little bit of the numbers of the costs. So when they first heard about the medal, of course, they accused Sotheby's of trying to sell stolen property, which it was. But that allegation didn't go down well. They weren't interested in that, so they tried to put the legal bid together to stop the auction, and the courts required a bond of $850,000 to cover costs which could arise if the hapū lost its case. So that's, it sounds like a value that's been put together to make sure that no one really tries very hard to stop that. I imagine Sotheby's has this happen quite a bit, an actual fact or potential for this. So instead of that, on the evening of the auction, some of the relatives living in Sydney went and protested outside Sotheby's. The group was evicted from the auction house. They did a haka, I think, and a ritualistic prayer as well. And it discouraged many people who were going to bid for the Te Pahi medal, leaving just two bidders. So one was the Combined Museums from New Zealand, and the other was, I don't know who the other was. So the value of the medal, the medal had been valued by Sotheby's at between $300,000 to $500,000, and was bought by the two museums for $300,000. So they successfully kept the price down with their actions over there, which was the only good news in that relationship with Sotheby's. So yeah, this, and you, it's funny, sometimes I think my pronunciation's not so good, but Naranoa said that they really struggled to get the Australians. They've worked really hard, tried really hard to get the pronunciation right, but it seemed to be quite a challenge.